And we especially appreciate your being here today because of the tiny amount of snow, but apparently very slick roads and many accidents. So because of that, we're going to start with the second case on the docket this morning, which is TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP versus Tandarup et al. I should note that Justice Miller Lerman is having traffic issues this morning, too. She is going to be participating on the briefs on this case. Also, she's recused on the very last case of the day, First State Bank Nebraska versus MP Next Level LLC. But she will be, if she does not make it here soon, she will be participating on the briefs on all of the other cases for today. With that, we will begin. And Mr. Powers, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. I and Patrick Pepper are here on behalf of the appellant, TransCanada Keystone Pipeline LP, in this matter. I have asked and will intend to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We are here on 16 consolidated appeals out of Antelope County. This is the third group of appeals, the Keystone involving the Keystone Pipeline, an application for attorney fees pursuant to Number of Stat 76-276. Antelope is the last group. Previously, there's been 42 appeals that have all been before this court, and all the previous applications have been dismissed due to the failure of the condominees to establish that they were entitled to reimbursement under that statute. At the heart of this case and the heart of the last two that have appeared before you is this court's ruling in TransCanada Keystone Pipeline versus Nicholas Family Limited Partnership. That is what formed much of the basis of the county court's decision in Antelope County. And hereafter, I'll just refer to it as the Nicholas case. So the issue today, and first thing to note, is when the condominees appealed the decision dismissing their attorney fee application, no assignment of error was filed by them. As a result, the appellate review mandated is plain error. That's true at the district court and, of course, here today. And that's the issue.
What difference does that make?
Well, the difference is the standard of review, and what you have to look at, and what this court has to look at is, did the decision of the county court dismissing the fee application substantially prejudice the did it prejudicially affect the substantial legal right of the condominees to the extent that a miscarriage of justice would apply if not corrected, or did it damage the integrity, fairness, or reputation of the judicial system?
Your opponent is arguing that the scope of remand was violated. And you seem to be relying upon some sort of agreement or stipulation immediately following remand after the first appeal. What does the plain language of that agreement or stipulation say?
That stipulation is found at transcript 97 to 98. It says that the set the stage for that. The county court had just set for evidentiary hearing twice. The condominees moved to continue that hearing pending the outcome of the Nicholas case. That stipulation says because these cases are closely associated with the Nicholas case, they asked to indefinitely continue the hearing on that case pending the outcome of the Nicholas case, as it may impact the decision or that may impact these proceedings.
So what is closely associated mean?
Well, closely associated means that the parties believe that there was no reason. They had their chance for their day in the court. They believe that the outcome of that case could potentially resolve this case, these cases. And so it was closely associated because the issues were the same. The attorneys, the fees they were seeking were the same. Remember, in Nicholas, the attorney fees were not individually allocated. They were dealt with on a pro rata basis. So what you had is they were split up between 59 condominees. So the what happened at that point, six counties were on their way to the Supreme Court. Six different counties. There had been split decisions at the district courts, if the court recalls, and the fact was the same issues were going to be decided in this case, and that would impact the outcome of the Antelope County cases. There's fifth, and why plain error is so important is because did this somehow substantially impact a legal right of the condominees to the extent that if not corrected, it would do that be unfair or a miscarriage of justice. It would be a miscarriage of justice to have the 42 appellees that did not, or condominees that did not get a chance to go back to district court and get fees. It's all the same fees. In fact, Judge Taylor, in her decision, cited the Nicholas case and cited the fact that in Holt and York County, this court remanded the district court, or the district court remanded to the county court for further proceeding, but this court instructed that be dismissed and not be remanded.
So nobody requested the district court on the second appeal to stay its mandate, or on the first appeal, right?
No, that's correct.
Nobody requested. So the mandate issued, and that, wouldn't that have been the logical point at which to put the hold on the proceedings while it was still within the appellate court's grasp?
Not for TransCanada. We had won that hearing and mandated back. So we were prepared to go forward at that time. And the mandate, I think the issue here is that the mandate itself, there's an exception to the rule in that the mandate necessitates a complete new hearing. In Yost and in the cases cited in our brief, if the district court or the trial court determines that the outcome would be the same, that there's nothing that would happen differently, you do not have to have another evidentiary hearing. That's the rule in Nebraska. Judge Taylor, having been through this twice on evidentiary hearings and had been there ready to set it and had the condominees asked twice to continue it, said that she would not, in her discretion, and she has that ability as inherent power of the court, to limit the evidence that would be accepted or not accepted at the trial. And she determined she would not allow them to enter any evidence beyond what was already submitted in their affidavits.
What authority did she have to limit the scope of the evidence to come in following the district court remand?
Just her inherent power to control the matters before the court. In other words, it's no different than the other evidence. She made rules on evidence. She decided that she believed the evidence that would come in would be limited to what was, already in, that she had already heard in the affidavits.
Was it her actual ruling that she did not allow any evidence to come in because the affidavits had been thrown out? Remand?
On the remand, she never, her ruling on the remand was, no, she said the evidence, she would allow evidence, but the evidence she would allow in her discretion, and that's the issue why plain error is so important, in her discretion, she would allow no evidence outside of what was already submitted in the affidavits.
But the remand said a rehearing on the merits is appropriate, correct?
It said a rehearing was appropriate. And the rule in Nebraska is when you have a rehearing, it was a general remand. You do not have to have a full-blown evidentiary hearing if the court determines that the evidence would be is of such a nature that it would not change the outcome. And the last,
how did she know that was the case?
She already dealt with the evidence. This was her second time. She initially
did the appellees or anybody make an offer of proof and say, look, if we have a hearing, we're going to offer this kind of evidence?
They did not, that I'm aware of. And another reason you ask why, or you mentioned why is it important if it's a substantial plain error? This attorney fee application is a collateral matter. It's a collateral proceeding. This court clearly determined that in Nicholas and used that finding in Nicholas to allow hearsay evidence. Normally, you wouldn't allow hearsay evidence by affidavit. So if you allow hearsay evidence, I don't think you can claim it's a substantial legal right at issue. This is a collateral matter on the attorney fees, and the question is, did she abuse her discretion in limiting the evidence. As a trier, she has a right to decide what evidence would come in and what wouldn't. And she was there. She witnessed the stipulation, the parties. She found it inexplicable. The Condoneezza argued, and you'll see it in the transcript, that it was inexplicable that we would say this court should be, that the Nicholas case would impact it. She found it very explicable. She went through the laundry list of how all the issues were the same, how everything was the same, and that she thought that that under those circumstances, you can't game the system and come back later and say we're not bound by that stipulation. Clearly, we intended that the Nicholas case would resolve it. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jordy, good morning to you.
Yes, good morning. May it please the court, Brian Jordy, Adama Law, on behalf of all landowner appellees in this matter. I think Judge Castle hit on the right question, which is, was the scope of remand violated? And we think this is pretty simple. District court says remand for hearing on the merits. No hearing occurred, no opportunity to present any evidence, no opportunity to even say, well, yes, we're going to go ahead and reoffer all the same affidavits. So there was no evidence because there was no rehearing. And that is the fundamental problem. Had there been a rehearing, we would have and could have put on new additional evidence, as could have appellants.
How do we know from this record that that was your intention?
Well, I don't think it's important whether it was or was not our intention, because the mandate itself said rehearing on the merits, and the county court's order following remand specifically contemplated and said if the parties want to put on new affidavit evidence, then submit them to us 20 days in advance. Obviously, we wouldn't submit anything to the court 20 days in advance if it was already there on the original record. So I think the parties and the courts were all on the same page that remand for a new hearing on the merits meant specifically that. I really don't think it's much more complicated than that. The county court...
Well, let me ask you, did you make some kind of offer of proof? Did you say to the judge, we are going to give you this evidence, this evidence, and this evidence?
We didn't even have that opportunity because there was no rehearing. That's the problem. We didn't even have the chance to appear with either live witnesses, old evidence, new evidence, some combination, and say, hey, we're ready to go. I mean, you can't do an offer of proof unless you're at trial or at a hearing. We didn't even have a hearing where we could even put on an offer of proof, which I agree could have been something that could have been done had we even been in the courtroom. But we never got there because the judge just on it her own said there is not going to be any new hearing. I'm just deciding this.
So what's the time interval between when our Nicholas opinions came out and when the county judge's order was entered?
So Nicholas came out in March 2018, and the county court order was filed July 31st, 2018, the second county court order, right? So on the non-remand order, right? Because we started from county court to district court, we went back down to county court, up to district court, and now we're here because of the district court interpretation of the county court failure to act on remand. So that's the time sequence. Again, I think the court misinterpreted State v. Hank in stating that we couldn't put on new evidence because in the Hank matter, it was a post-conviction where the party came back and said, well, we have new claims. In this case, we weren't going to present new claims.
So there was roughly 3 or 4 months in which either party could have requested the court, we need the evidentiary hearing, let us present evidence.
That's true, and we wanted to have that hearing, and we met with Judge Taylor on kind of a status checkup where she's like, well, what should I do? Should I have a new hearing or shouldn't I? So we didn't have a hearing on the merits. It was kind of like, well, what do you think about a hearing? And at that time, we vehemently said, and it's in the record, we want a new hearing. There should be a new hearing. We're going to call witnesses. We're going to comply with the district court order. And none of that was ever allowed to occur.
Should it have any impact on this matter that the other similar situated litigants from the other counties could potentially be treated significantly different than these litigants?
No, I don't think so at all. And again, yes, there's some similarities, but the procedural posture here is so critical because neither party appealed the initial district court ruling, which sent it back down. So we're in a completely different procedural framework. Each client, each landowner themselves has their own motion, their own claim, their own evidence specific to them. And I don't think it's a case where this court says, well, gosh, maybe other people in other counties were treated differently. They didn't have this. Well, the district court judges ruled differently. And so we're on a procedural posture that's different. We have to follow the mandate, and we would respectfully request that the district court be affirmed, that this be remanded back down to county court with the instructions to hold a rehearing on the merits, which was intended years ago and never.
What is our standard of review here? Is it a plain error standard?
I believe it is. It is plain error, and our argument is, as the district court found, there could be no error more plain than a complete and total abject failure to follow the higher court, the district court's mandate. I mean, rehearing on the merits, nope, we're not going to have a hearing. There's no more plain error than that.
What's your argument for the second half of the plain error standard about either a miscarriage of justice or damaging the reputation of the judiciary?
Certainly. It would be a miscarriage of justice for landowners to go forward on a reimbursement of fee and cost shifting provision at 76-726 and not have any evidence, because that's the posture we're in. District court says affidavits are out, and affidavits were all that were offered. So now the miscarriage of justice is the county court, instead of rehearing it, is saying, well, there's no evidence before me, and on no evidence, I'm going to reverse myself on my prior order awarding fees and costs. So,
well, we've kind of been over this already this morning, but this is part of a larger series of cases and kind of a unique situation. Doesn't the fact that the other landowners in other counties were treated the same way, doesn't that figure into the miscarriage of justice aspect that we have to look at here?
No. Those landowners are not parties to this cases. The affidavit, the evidence, the proceedings aren't part or incorporated into your record. What my client does in North Platte versus a client unrelated to them in some other county is totally irrelevant as to how things shake out.
Were they parties to the representation and the contracts entered into with the parties and legal counsel?
Each client had an individual separately signed fee agreement.
Same agreement?
That covered the relationship. Well, it was separate per client. There was not one omnibus.
Same language, same terms, same conditions?
That's true, and the signatures were only each individual client. So no rights cross, even if they're similar agreements. There's no privity from the other.
It was the same representation, wasn't it?
It was similar representation, but the land condemned is specific by legal description and separate case. This is not a class action or a mass action. Every single case number consolidated on this appeal is concerning a separate tract of ground in a separate proceeding with separate evidence and separate motions. This isn't like an omnibus proceeding. It's all very specific. Thank you very much.
There was no other stipulation between the parties regarding that continuance than other that was in the written document, was there?
There was not. And the only item I think you're referencing is a joint stipulated motion, which specifically references matters in the Nebraska Court of Appeals, of which there were none. And I don't believe this stipulated motion, frankly, has any weight in this case. And the phrase "may impact the matters" is nonspecific and without any real meaning. It may not.
But that document's the only.
Yes,
that's
Your Honor.
The agreement is.
That's the only agreement where the word "stipulated" ever appears.
Does the record disclose who drafted that document?
The record does not disclose, but if you turn to the second page, which is I believe page 98, T98, in the bottom left-hand corner, that's the McGrath North way of. Their word processing, the Domino Law is different. It's just one number. And so I would submit to you that it's a McGrath North drafted motion that was signed by both parties.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 50 seconds.
50 seconds, Mr. Powers.
Your Honor, Judge Taylor specifically made her ruling to prevent a miscarriage of justice in this case. She was there. They had their chance for an evidentiary hearing. They had two chances. I don't know who drafted it. I don't have the document with me, but it was their motion to continue. She set it for an evidentiary hearing twice, and the landowners are the ones who moved to continue it and proceed without it. With respect to the mandate...
So is that some kind of estoppel argument?
For them? No, if they're arguing that they were should have had their day in court, Your Honor, they chose to move the hearing pending a closely associated case. It is the same fees. There's no individual. They took all the fees. It may not be a mass tort case, but there's no individual allocation of the fees per client. There's no itemization for the Antelope County that's any different than anyone else because there's no itemization. That's why this court rejected the application to start with. They chose not to go forward. That was why we ended up and we stipulated. And they to argue that Nicholas is some sort of different ship in the night is exactly what they tried to argue to Judge Taylor, and she found that that didn't make sense. She was there. It was explicable. She thought that it was very obvious why it was considered to be impact her decision. And the court does have a mandate in the Yost case that I cited. It doesn't, there's a general mandate, it doesn't always mean that you have to have an evidentiary full hearing. It just does not. If the outcome is the same, and in this case, she found it was. She'd been through it, she made the decision, and she had the inherent right as a trial judge to ensure fairness and said their evidence would be limited to what was in the affidavit, previously in their affidavit.
Isn't there a chance that they would learn from the Nicholas case if they were given another opportunity and their evidence would be presented in a different manner, which potentially could justify the fees?
Well, there's a chance that the intent is not, there's no, to go to school on the Nicholas case and have these 16 people be condemnees be treated differently based on what the holding was. If that was the case, Judge Taylor, in her discretion, might have ruled differently. She found that it was clear, and she cites that in the well-reasoned, single-spaced, eight-page opinion, her basis for finding that, and she didn't think it would be a miscarriage of justice to allow one group to choose to not go forward and let the six other counties, the 42 other condemnees, go forward on all the same evidence, the same fees. There's just no difference in it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.